You are never going to get people out of poverty if you don't change their productivity. And the way to change their productivity is to enable them to take on different types of work.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, a series of interviews with leading policy practitioners and economists around the world. My name is Tim Phillips, and today I'm speaking to Robin Burgess, Professor of Economics at the London School of Economics and a director of the International Growth Centre, about his recent work. This is focused on how to change the life chances of the very poor by creating policies targeted specifically at them. Robin, a lot of your recent work has been on the quality of civil servants. I suppose the thinking behind this is that you can have the best policy prescriptions in the world, but nothing's going to happen unless those policies are delivered.
I think that's right. I think what differentiates state capacity across the world is the ability to implement policy. And there's a striking correlation between underdevelopment and the inability to implement policy. So I've become very interested working with a former PhD student, Guo Zhu at Berkeley, and Marianne Bertrand at Chicago, about what motivates civil servants. The reason that's a very important question is, A, the jobs that civil servants do are so central to development, but also the fact we don't really understand what motivates them, given that they're not elected and they typically have jobs for life. So we've been working on a couple of papers, one on how entering the civil service late, which makes it less likely you reach the top echelons of it, demotivates you. And the second on the effect of assigning civil servants to the state from which they originated, and whether they suffer elite capture or whether they are more motivated to go back home to work in those states. Both of these papers are using the Indian Administrative Service officers in India, who essentially run India. And so it's a particularly interesting set of questions to think about how you would motivate these individuals, given that they run all state departments at the state and federal level, but also to think again about what is it that makes these people work, what gets them out of bed. And I think this is, relative to politicians or individuals in the private sector, this is a massively understudied area, and an area which I think is of central importance to development, simply because politicians churn over and the people who are actually running governments are civil servants. The ministers come and go, but the civil servants are always there, and the quality and motivation of those individuals has a central bearing on development.
Did you find out anything from this work that's applicable in a wider context?
I think a couple of things. One is that the career concerns of bureaucrats really matter for how well they perform. And those career concerns can be to do with possibilities for promotion, it can be to do with incentives, financial and other. And so when we think about the careers of civil servants across a range of developed and developing countries, we need to think very carefully about what motivates them. And that, I think, has been largely absent from the literature. Because at a kind of basic level, if these are, as was sort of promulgated in the 1854 Northcote Trevelyan report, the whole point of a permanent civil service is to have a backbone of government that knows how to implement policy despite whatever political turnover there is. One thing that has been sort of absent from the discussion, say, of civil servants in Africa is the fact that if your career concerns get distorted to a point that you're looking for private gain from donor money or other money, then you may just simply give up doing the job you're intended to do. And that has catastrophic consequences for the countries that are these civil servants are working in.
You've also been working recently on why the very poor stay poor, mm-hmm. and how that happens. What do we know about this?
I guess in the last 3-4 years, I've become very, very interested in the area of labour and development, simply because when you look at the jobs that people do, that's heavily correlated with how poor they are. So if you look across South Asia, for example, the very poorest people are either landless labourers or working in very itinerant wage labour. So in a project with Oriana Bandiera, Imran Rasool, and a range of other researchers, we've become very interested in what policies might change that. And a long time ago, in 2006, I came across a program by the world's largest NGO, BRAC, where they were trying to transfer assets and training to very poorest women in Bangladeshi villages. The idea being that these were women that were unreached even by microfinance, because they exhibited no demand for capital. They were simply either domestic servants or agricultural laborers. So we conducted a randomized control trial of that program, where the women chose small businesses to run, mainly livestock. And what we found, interestingly, is that once they got the opportunity to run these businesses, they were able to do so. And not only that, they continue to expand these businesses. And we're going back and doing the survey of their children this year. But we have data from 2009 to 2007 as the baseline, 2009, 2011, and 2014. We're finding a very consistent pattern of women expanding their labor supply. So one of the problems with itinerant wage labor like agricultural labor is you don't work all days of the year. But having a livestock business, it means you have to put some hours in each day. So by working more hours and more days in a year, they're becoming about 36% richer. And importantly, they're now able to diversify into other assets. So the fundamental point of that project is essentially two views of poverty, as sort of view, which is people are poor because they have unproductive traits. And so they're doing what they can, but they're unproductive, and the only one to stop them from being poor is to provide transfers. Another view of poverty is that people are poor because they lack opportunity. And those opportunities may be capital, it may be human capital, but there's something preventing them from engaging in better jobs. And this paper fairly conclusively proves that this very, very simple production environment where there's a very limited occupational choice, that even the very, very poorest women, which are 93% illiterate, are able to take on the jobs that the richer women are doing in those villages and hence to exit poverty. And that is a very important insight for the world, because if we're looking toward the sustainable development goal on poverty, that's not about reducing poverty, it's about eradicating extreme poverty. So there's this huge rump of people who are working really, really bad, very unproductive jobs. And we need to think growth will pull some of those people out, but not all of them. So we need to think of targeted policies to change the occupations these people are engaged in, because if you don't do that, then you can continue to bump them up to higher levels of consumption through transfers, but you'll not allow them to exit poverty. So then one of the most important features of this program is it only lasts for 2 years. And after 2 years, there is no involvement of the NGO, and yet these people are continuing to show an upward trajectory in terms of earnings. So they're actually moving away from poverty despite there being no further assistance. So this is sort of two ways of tackling poverty. One is the transfer one, where you have to do it continue, like unemployment benefits and so forth in the UK. Or another one where you provide capital and human capital, allow people to take on different employment activities. And that, through their own efforts, enables them to leave poverty.
This surely has a huge implication for the economic development of many of the world's poorest countries.
So I think the key insight, and it's relevant not just for developing countries, also relevant for developed countries, is we need to change the way we think about welfare, to think about production rather than just about consumption. You are never going to get people out of poverty if you don't change their productivity. And the way to change their productivity is to enable them to take on different types of work. Because effectively, for most of humanity, they don't have assets. So effectively, their income is the number of hours they work and the return on each hour of work. And if that return is either very few hours of work or the return on each hour is extremely low, then you remain poor. Whether it's the UK or Zambia, you need to think about whether we can find big push. And it has to be big push. I mean, the program we looked at in Bangladesh is expensive. We have to inject a lot of capital and human capital at the same time to essentially shock people out of this low-level equilibrium and enable them to work in different activities. And if you can do that, and we show you can do that in Bangladesh, and this program is now being moved to many other countries and now being implemented by many governments, then you can get this rump of people who are in these almost sort of medieval-type jobs into a better situation as regards poverty.
You also have been looking into why so many of the world's poorest people still live without electricity today. Why is this still the case?
I think I have this sort of inkling, which is not completely proven, which says that if you want to engage in any modern production activity, whether it's services, manufacturing, you need to have some source of electricity. If you do the thought experiment of what activities you can engage in the absence of electricity, then they're extremely restricted. And so when we began to look at what the state of affairs is in electricity around the world, what we found is it's even more broken than in areas in health and education. So you find vast swathes of the earth without electricity, and then you find even more people who have electricity, but on a very irregular basis. So pretty much anybody who's traveled in the developing world will notice blackouts. They'll probably also notice that much of the countryside is black. And so we asked the question, well, that doesn't make sense, because presumably people would like to have electricity. Why are they not getting it? And the reason that we've come up with is essentially that electricity in these countries is treated as a right as opposed to a private good. If it's treated as a right, then you may, for example, introduce many subsidies into the provision of electricity. You may countenance people stealing the electricity, both of which are done extensively in India, where we work. And so with Michael Greenstone from Chicago and Nick Ryan from Yale and Nant Sudarshan from Chicago, we began working about 6 years ago in the poorest state of Bihar, but where they had a government which was intent on changing that. So the chief minister in that state, Nitish Kumar, made a public political statement that unless the situation for electricity improved dramatically, he was not going to run in the next election. And that was our marker to get in and to work directly with the government on different means of doing that. And the main way we've been doing that is to basically, for a randomized control trial involving 28 million people, we provide schedules whereby if a community pays its bills, then they get more hours of electricity. Because in the state, because of the mismatch between demand and supply, load shedding and blackouts are common. So what we're doing now is before, the load shedding was unrelated to payment performance. Now we're linking the two. So if you pay more, a higher fraction of your community pays their bills, then that community, which is about 2,500 people, will get more hours of electricity. And we're finding that has big effects in incentivizing people to actually pay for these goods that they value. In some sense, breaking this equilibrium of non-payment. And we feel we've happened onto something very, very important, because there's different ways you can get into this. You can do this sort of group incentives thing. You could also incentivize the bill collectors, because they're often colluding with the customers to allow non-payment. You can think of privatizing payment collection. You can think of introducing metering, which is not been done extensively, partly because the use of electricity for the very poorest consumers is very, very low, and hence not worth metering. But as technology improves, you can think of smart metering, where you can remotely assess what electricity is being used. So we've pushed on this project on how treating electricity as a right is a real problem in Bihar, and we're now moving to working in Myanmar, because what we've recognized across the developing world, this is a problem. And breaking this problem is not to do with building more generation plants for electricity. It's actually to do with fixing the distribution of this and making sure that if you're a distributor of electricity, you get paid for the electricity that you distribute.
Are there places where this would be a very good solution, but it's not politically feasible?
I think that is definitely the case. I think when subsidies get baked into societies, it becomes difficult to remove them. So you definitely need political will to move away. But I do think that there has been a shift, both at the national level and the state level in India, where the politicians and the civil servants recognize the population really want electricity. And so they've moved towards, for example, the state has been subsidizing on a massive scale in India the initial connection a household receives to electricity. So I think that it is possible, it is difficult. It is a political economy problem at source. But my basic reckoning is, given how backward Bihar is, if we are able to solve this problem in Bihar, and we see massive expansions in electricity provision in Bihar, then that could be emblematic for other states, because other policymakers would think, if they can do it in Bihar, we can do it in another Indian state. And indeed, hopefully some of these findings then trickle over to areas like Africa, which is, again, the most unelectrified part of the developing world. But to give you a sense of the problem in Bihar, when we started working in Bihar about 5 years ago, it was just as unelectrified as the poorer parts of Africa. So we're hoping, and there has been massive progress made in Bihar, that this set of projects in terms of incentivizing people to pay will point to solutions for other parts of India, for other parts of the developing world. Because essentially the world has now divided into areas of the globe, which now include China, which is the 24-hour electricity parts of the globe. And then pretty much all the developing parts of the world do not have those characteristics, including India. And you wonder whether that's putting them at a huge competitive disadvantage, because you were thinking of setting up a firm and you couldn't get electricity 24 hours a day, then you wouldn't set up in those countries. There's both a kind of a household element of that, but there's even a bigger one on firms. That if you want modern firms in an economy, it's a necessary condition for industrialization.
Robin Burgess, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more podcasts from VoxDev, check out our website at voxdev.org.